This rip of TFTC was brought to you by River. It's the best place to buy Bitcoin. Go to river.com/TFTC and enjoy this episode.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
All right. Now we're live, Ian. Welcome to the show.
Absolutely, man. Good to meet you. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I'm happy we're able to do this. I think the work that you are doing is extremely important, highlighting corruption and the inability of the media to cover big events going on in the world is more pressing as time moves forward, as the incumbent political intelligence banking apparatus loses control. They're really going to try and clamp down on speech. And that's certainly happening throughout the first 6 months of this year globally. So I think the work you're doing is really important. I've been following you on Twitter for, I think, almost a year now. And I think we need more voices like yours out there. So I'm just happy that you agreed to come on.
Yeah, thanks, man. Yeah, we're definitely just getting warmed up too. There's a lot of 2024 left ahead of us.
Yeah, what do you think in that regard? Like, what are you looking out for? Obviously, we got the election here.
Yeah, I'm thinking about all the possibilities, and I tend to speculate forwards on based on what we know now about what's happening right now. Like the election is a good example with Trump. It's like we know a lot about Trump, and it's important to have a slightly like an unbiased take on Trump, because there's a lot of people that have a really biased negative take on Trump and a lot of people that have a really biased positive take on Trump. And so in the case of the election, I try to look at hopefully just the facts and what we know about him and what we know about the prosecution and the various, you know, agencies and such that are interested in him not getting elected. And based on what we know, it's like going forwards, what are the possible like operations or realities that we might be seeing playing out? And it's hard to say for sure what's really going on with the prosecution, but looking forwards, we can look for evidence of the various different, you know, possibilities to sort of hopefully by the time November rolls around, have a sense for like what the hell they're doing and whether or not Trump is genuine in what he's saying and what team is he really playing for, which I don't think there's simple answers to any of that. I think that it's a very complex milieu of reality.
Yeah, I've always been under the impression that Trump's just playing for Team Trump. Has really tapped into the populist zeitgeist, if you will. That's why
that's a good way to put it, honestly, is Team Trump. Because like Team Trump, his personal identity, like there is a lot of like America first in Trump's personal identity, I think. But I don't know if it's necessarily rooted in the real populist sentiment that Trump supporters want to extract from what they like kind of put onto him. Cause Trump is not like us. Like he is not from our world. He's not one of us. And I mean, sure. Like he does speak in ways that sound like they support us, but I'm not sure that if you actually look at his 4 years as president, it's like, did he really actually look out for us? Like, I don't know.
No. I mean, Operation Warp Speed is a big one. There's a lot of people. I've brought it up on Twitter many times. Like, hey, like isn't Trump the guy that started Operation Warp Speed? And people hopped in the reply saying, oh, it wasn't really him. He didn't really have control. He was more open. But it's like, I think he sort of did.
Yeah. He's a lot more complicit in that than a lot of people want to admit. And it's not necessarily that he masterminded anything. It's not necessarily that it was all his idea or he was like, it's possible that he just got played. It's possible that his, you know, financial interests just leaned on him hard enough, or that he wasn't informed enough to stick up for what needed to happen at the time it needed to happen. It's not like, I think people try to always go to black and white versions of what's going on when it's always more complicated than that. But yeah, Operation, I mean, with Fauci's hearing coming up, Operation Warp Speed is big on my mind. And I've been doing a lot of digging into Fauci. I'm planning on doing a show about that later this week, because COVID reckoning is kind of hitting the mainstream media a little bit now in an important way. And I don't, like, it's important that people don't forget about what the fuck that was.
No. And I really hope, I mean, I wouldn't even say cautiously optimistic. I don't think I have any hope that there will be a reckoning, but it does seem like the public conversation around it is certainly changing. I think he had a large, I think it was the Telegraph in London, come out with an article yesterday or the day before saying, hey, like, excess deaths may be driven by the vaccine, which is a big wow. Like, they're finally admitting it after.
Yeah. Like, oh shit, you mean that thing that we were all saying for years now? Yeah, it's neat how it's leaking out into the various foreign medias in countries that are not as controlled by American big pharma. And you can sort of see in real time the monetary reach of the, like, sort of American-based pharmaceutical establishment, and sort of see where their like power system not necessarily ends, but where it fizzles a little bit. And those are the places where we're starting to get honest reporting about what really has happened, because those countries are pissed, rightfully so.
Well, it all comes down to ad dollars, right? Because the US and New Zealand are the only two countries where these large pharmaceutical companies can actually advertise. And so in these areas where there's no financial motive in terms of ad revenue, even possible, like, it makes sense that they would be more open about these conversations.
100%. And during the event, like, there was a lot of political pressures and motivations, like, on a global scale, like, Western power sort of aligning around political objectives around the pandemic. And there was a lot more sort of elements that encouraged cohesion about the lies. But now that that's all gone, it's like you're saying, it's like the dollars aren't there, the political motivation isn't there, and they're dealing with, because they're all dealing with the fallout of these sort of, like, American, it's hard to even call them American, these, like, Western pharmaceutical companies malpractice, essentially. And so they're left with all the consequences and no more motivation to cover it up, which is kind of exciting.
Yeah. And then, yeah, like, I've had Ed Dowd on a few times throughout the years, and I'm sure you're aware of him, but I think what he's honed in on is that at the end of the day, the insurance companies literally can't talk their way out of the cost that they're incurring due to people's life insurance claims being claimed because they're dying at excess rates. And you literally have this large vaccine rollout that many people took beginning to affect financial markets, particularly the insurance companies, that it, like, you, it's a problem that you can't hide in a balance sheet. Like, it's being laid bare in terms of the financials.
Yeah. Yeah. The money always talks.
Yeah. And I think with the emergence of RFK, what people think about his particular campaign is one thing or another, but I think the focus on Fauci and vaccines in general has really brought up the fact that, and most people don't know this, but Fauci was front and center with the AIDS crisis as well, with AZT, and the fact that we gave this guy the reins of public health policy again after the disaster that was killing tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, I think globally, of individuals by forcing AZT on them is something that more people should be aware of.
Yeah. I mean, it's telling about how a lack of education, reporting, and historical understanding is critical to the sort of, like, mechanisms of control and manipulation that these people in power rely on. Because, like, for exactly what you're talking about right now, I'm partway through RFK's book about Fauci right now. And if everyone knew, like, just the most basic facts about Fauci's career, no one would have ever stood for him being the COVID czar. It would have been the most ridiculous proposition ever, because his playbook is exactly what he's done his entire career. And what he did during COVID is, like, blatantly fraudulent in the exact same way it's always been. But because no one knows those sorts of things, because no one reports on it, because there's incentives not to, everyone just got played all over again.
Yeah. What do you think? Do you think justice prevails here? I mean, obviously, he was on the Hill a couple days ago. I think he's going to be on again. But, I mean, it's obvious he overtly tried to skirt FOIA requests by telling people to email a certain way to the point where he had individuals changing characters of their name to like dollar signs. On top, the NIH, what is it? Global Health Alliance, mm-hmm. or Eco Alliance?
Yeah, like Eco Health Alliance.
Yeah. All these things are intertwined, and the whole like lab leak theory. It's like I think it's become clear that it was most likely a lab leak, but even he's still denying it on the Hill. And I think I would say, like, from what I've seen, it seems like he's perjuring himself.
Like, yeah, I mean, I'm curious to see what comes out of like the Jim Jordan clip that's circulating right now. Like, Jim has obviously a lot of flaws. He's not a great politician either, but he did seem to sort of be intentionally trying to catch Fauci in a perjury on the stand when he asked Fauci about whether he had downplayed the role of the lab leak theory or not. And Fauci clearly lied about his role in that. So I don't know as I'm necessarily holding out for any successful reckoning coming out of what's going on right now. But one thing I do think about all the time is how we are currently in the midst of a technological like revolution, a fundamental shift in the way that all culture works and in the way that government works, because government is based on culture, right? And so I don't think that the people that sort of are pulling the strings of the various pieces of our world are young enough and wise enough to really understand the effect that social media and sort of like the new media landscape has on political structures and power structures. And I think the court of public opinion has shown time and time again that it has a ton of power in ways that are hard to guess before they actually play out. Here, I'm going to move this a little bit so that it hopefully doesn't keep brightening up from my window. So I'm of the opinion that I hope that we're in an unprecedented time of us all collectively changing our minds and getting loud about a problem can hopefully do more than it's done in the past to make real change. And I'm kind of optimistic about that.
I am as well. I mean, it's in the digital age, particularly the social media age. I mean, this is a famous Rogan clip back in the day when he was talking about the internet and podcasting and stuff like that. But it's like literally a deluge of information. It's like a river that is massively wide. And you have one individual, the intelligence apparatus, the government, whatever it may be, in the middle, like with a small net trying to catch all the fish. It's overwhelming to an extent.
That's a good way to put it. And this is actually one of the things I focus on the most in my reporting is intelligence agencies and their role in all of this. And I think that it's intentional and criminal how undereducated the public is about what intelligence agencies actually do and how involved they are in our daily lives. And I think that the more people that can wake up to the role that intel agencies, not just the CIA, like foreign intel agencies too, adversarial ones and allegedly allied ones, like every intel agency has a serious interest in what the public thinks. Like that's the nature of the Cold War era. That's the nature of like the nuclear age, really, is like now that real kinetic conflict is sort of dampened globally, the inherent type of conflict you turn to is like cultural conflict and cultural subversion. And I mean, that goes back long before computers, but now that we live in this digital age, like cultural subversion happens in your Twitter feed. It happens in your Instagram feed. It happens on the news articles that are coming out to influence what we all think. And every intelligence agency inherently is interested in that. Like the foreign ones that are trying to subvert us in a negative way, they obviously want to change what we all think to break our country apart, to break our culture apart. But then inherently that means that our intelligence agency that's supposed to be looking out for us, the way you combat that is by them controlling what we see and think before enemies can. And so it's inherently like our whole information space is a intelligence agency battlefield, more or less. Yeah.
The ghost and the machine, as they will commonly refer to themselves.
This episode was presented by River. River is the best, most secure place to buy Bitcoin in the United States. Go to river.com/TFTC, set up an account today. You'll be able to DCA into Bitcoin without paying any fees. You'll be able to give people Bitcoin via River links. You'll be able to send and receive Bitcoin over the Lightning Network. And you'll be able to set limit orders. If you want to buy Bitcoin at a particular price below or above where it is now, you can set orders to buy Bitcoin when it hits that price. Go to river.com/TFTC and set up your account today. This trip was also brought to you by our good friends at Unchained. Unchained is building a financial services platform for a Bitcoin standard. They have over 7,000 clients that are securing over 90,000 Bitcoin with 12,000 keys on their platform. Their platform leverages Bitcoin's native multi-sig properties. Their cornerstone product is their Vault product, a 2 of 3 multi-sig Vault, which allows you to hold 2 of 3 keys in a multi-sig quorum. That gives you full control over your Bitcoin. They also have an IRA product, a lending desk, and they're rolling out a bunch of other products, including inheritance protocol and sound advisory. So go to unchained.com, set up a call with their concierge onboarding team today, tell them that TFTC sent you, and use the promo code TFTC at checkout. Unchained.com.
And that's why I honestly think COVID was one of the biggest missteps by this global intelligence apparatus, because it really woke people up to, holy shit, we're being played on a massive scale. When you combine the fact that they covered up the lab leak theory with the vaccine rollout, historically, you've been told to get a safe vaccine to market, you're going to need 10 to 15 years of testing. They're like, yeah, we can do this in 9 months. That was initially why I was like, I'm going to hold off on this. And then you do more research into who's involved. And it's like, I'm definitely going to hold off on this. And then on top of that, like the masking, social distancing, the humiliation ritual that people went through, and then coming out the other end being like, holy shit, I can't believe we did that. What else are they lying about? And then obviously what we focus on a lot here is Bitcoin. And once you see that the whole monetary system and financial system is a complete Ponzi scheme, and you're told it's the most secure system from a financial perspective that humanity's ever created. And it's like, all right, what else are they lying about? They're lying about essentially everything: food, health, money, education.
I mean, that's actually a really important aspect to it too. It's like COVID, there's a couple of political things that I think woke a lot of people up. Be it like Black Lives Matter or like the treatment of January 6th, the election, Trump, all that. COVID, sort of those more political things woke a lot of people up in that arena. But then in what you're talking about, the monetary space, is like, now that we went through that crazy crypto cycle that exposed a lot of, shall we say, shortcomings and questions, not necessarily just in crypto itself, but in like the way it was treated, the way it was influencing the world, like Sam Bankman-Fried, just a lot of sketchy stuff there. That was sort of more like the more intelligent, tuned in people started to ask a lot of questions. But then simultaneously, we dip into like an economic, like almost collapse, like that affects everyone. The inflation that everyone's going through, that pain, like economically, starts to wake everyone up to what's going on, not just people that are interested in politics and not just people that are interested in crypto. And I think that the GameStop thing that happened sort of in the middle there is another example of something that sort of like woke up a sort of like niche but highly motivated crowd to start actually like digging through what kind of crime underlies the whole market space. And so sort of there's like a wake up call for everybody now. And it's really refreshing, despite how shitty a lot of it is.
Yeah. I mean, it's terrible to see people struggling financially, but I do think once you start really attacking the lower layers of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, particularly people's ability to feed themselves and shelter themselves, which inflation has significantly hindered over the last 3 years, people are forced to ask questions. I mean, that's one of the biggest trends on TikTok and Reels over the last year and a half, is people doing the selfie videos in their cars complaining either about their receipt at the grocery store or the amount of money they're making compared to how hard they're working.
Yeah. It's the kind of thing that everyone can understand and everyone feels right there in their lives, regardless of your age, your demographic. Like, the only people that don't get that are the people doing extremely well. And not only is that a small group of people, but it's also sort of like inherently the group of people that are kind of in on it in certain ways, those benefiting off of the corruption.
Yeah. And so you said you're optimistic. I'm as well. And that's one thing I try to do here at TFTC, and I think you do a good job of as well, which is, I think it's important to recognize that all this shit is fucked up in the world. There's corruption, and there's many different stakeholders trying to manipulate you in many different ways. But for a lot of people, it becomes all-consuming and somewhat nihilistic, where they feel like, I have no agency, I have no control. What we try to do, and again, why we focus on Bitcoin and Bitcoin specifically, not crypto, is I view Bitcoin as a tool to build yourself away from these problems, to build your way out of these problems. And I think that's what we need more of in the world, is people like yourself, myself, and other independent media operators. I never like to refer to myself as like a journalist or anything like that, but people putting out.
Yeah, I agree.
Independently. Just being like, yeah, shit's fucked up, but we can build our way out of this. And the most important thing is to recognize that things are messed up and the people that got us into this problem are not going to be the ones that get us out of it. Like, you've got do some things yourself.
What you're talking about this sort of like the black pill versus optimism. I think it's not a coincidence that the Bitcoin community is like on balance is more engaged with sort of like personal wellness or health or fitness or like personal finance. Like, they're Bitcoiners tend to be more tuned in to the types of things that like you can do for yourself in your own life to make your own life better. And I think that that's a big part of this sort of nihilism, is we, our culture and our education system and our like everything about the way that most Americans and people around the world live today sort of inherently pushes you to feel powerless and to just sort of be a drone and to not have any influence or say in what's going on. And it's easy to feel that way when you're looking outwards at the world and looking at what you can't change out there. But the moment you start to look at your own life and think about like what you can do for your own health or do for your own happiness or do for just to like shrinking that bubble down can help that optimism immensely, because the world has always had a million horrible things and a million good things. It's like, you know, we are 8 billion people all going through this experience of life together. And I think it's easy to find, like, just because we have so much information now, it's easy to find all these problems in the world, but they were always there. Like, and in a lot of ways, it was probably worse before because no one knew about them. So it was like smooth operation for all these people that were trying to control things. And now, like, yeah, we know about more problems, but knowing is, you know, the beginning of solving. So,
yeah, not only that, I'm not sure if you saw it during COVID, but I think it was The American Mind did a 2-part series on mass psychosis. The first defining the problem and highlighting that the world was engaged in mass psychosis with the lockdowns and the COVID reaction. And then the follow-up was, all right, how do you get out of mass psychosis? And it's literally ridiculing these people, because at the end of the day, I'd be interested to get your thoughts. Like, do you think there's some grand conspiracy, or do you think there's just this projection of expertise and power that is projected onto the public by these people in power? And at the end of the day, they're really a bunch of idiots who don't know what they're doing and are sort of just banking on the public's sort of catering to social hierarchy to get what they want.
I love this question. I think about it all the time right now. And my take on it has evolved as my understanding of the world has evolved through the work I do. And where I'm at now is I think that I think that I'm on the right track, and my opinion of this will only go deeper down this take, is that I think it's both. I think the answer is all of the above, as in, if you simplify the thought experiment here of like, is there a global conspiracy or a group of people controlling the world? It's like, imagine there's 1,000 billionaires in the world. Like, if there's 1,000 people above a certain threshold of power, what are the chances that one of them is the kind of person that thinks big and is kind of shitty and evil and wants like, and thinks they know what's best for the world? Like a Bill Gates, who like openly talks about how he is, you know, trying to, or even Elon Musk. Like, these are the kinds of people that have plans for the world, for what they see as making the world a better place. But it only takes, you know, a few people in those positions of immense power to think they know what's best for everyone and to also be evil, and for what's best for everyone to be kind of shitty, like eugenicist type mindsets, for them to create what is essentially a global conspiracy. Because you don't need everyone to be in on such a thing. Like, if you're a billionaire, you can orchestrate so many things. You can buy companies, you can start like nonprofits, you can influence politicians. You have like, just look at the amount of influence that a person like Bill Gates has amassed just by being really wealthy and having like an ego the size of fucking Mount Everest and just pushing his agenda onto the world. And I don't think that they're all on the same page. I don't think that there's like one table where everyone sits at and collectively makes a plan. But there are families, like we have very good historical precedent for family dynasties and sort of empire building that push and pull on each other, that work against each other sometimes and with each other other times. And I think that all of that plays out on a landscape where the vast majority of people of like the low powers of like the CEOs of the world, the, you know, just like the movers and shakers that are not at the top. A lot of those people are just like manipulable drones, or they're greedy bureaucrats that like greed is a really easy manipulate or emotion to manipulate. You know, if you have a greedy person with no morals, you can manipulate them all day. You just, you know, dangle the carrot in the direction you want them to take their company or whatever it is. And then you also have a lot of useful idiots that literally are just dumb enough to be misled. And I think that exists throughout every level of the power hierarchy. Like a lot of us regular folks are kind of, by default, the useful idiot, just by the way we're all pushed around by propaganda. And so I think for any given issue, you can look at the various power players or wealthy companies or individuals that are interested in controlling that narrative or that space, that idea, and then just look at the ways that their desire to influence that, be it a thing like vaccines or be it a thing like the war in Ukraine, and then just watch their influence sort of push downwards through various types of connections and contacts down to us. And it's not like it's one unified conspiracy, but there certainly is a lot of cohesion at some of the top levels.
Yeah. And as you were describing that, kind of help but think of like ESG and DEI initiatives as something that is put forth and just depends on useful idiots at the middle management layer of the broader power hierarchy, which would be the CEOs of a lot of these firms, pushing ESG and DEI initiatives that are completely counterproductive to human flourishing and meritocracy.
They always cloak it in like for the greater good, for the betterment of the planet, or for, you know, they always cloak it in something that sounds altruistic. And I think in a lot of, I think what that does is twofold, is it allows people to trick themselves into thinking it will be better for everybody, but it also allows the people like in power, like the CEOs, to sort of like explain to themselves their identity, to like rationalize how they're, what they're doing is right. Even if they actually know it's like, this is actually bullshit, but like, I think there's like multiple levels of why you cloak evil in a, you know, in sheep's clothing. And for some people, it's just so there's like for them to give themselves excuses to go along with it. For other people, it's because they're dumb enough to go along with it.
Yeah. Now my favorite hypocrisy within that broader ESG movement is actually built. Like, I think Bill Gates is objectively evil.
Yeah.
And I mean, you talk about his father was an overt eugenicist. And
I mean, he's an overt eugenicist too. He just uses new words about it these days.
Yeah. And his dad was a believer in like the population bomb theory too. And like wanted to, I think with Ted Turner, like lower the population of the world. And my favorite Bill Gates hypocrisy these days is a big environmental enthusiasts. We need to transition our grids away from hydrocarbons, nuclear energy, coal. Coal's a hydrocarbon, but we need to transition away from these reliable sources to wind and solar. And then on the other side of that, he's like, well we're actually going to blot out the sun to reduce the temperature. It's like, once you transition to solar power, and then we're going to block the sun so you can utilize none of it. It's like, wait a second.
Hold the phone. Yeah, he has a lot of those sort of, it's crazy actually how many things come out of Bill Gates' mouth that like literally two sentences next to each other say the exact opposite things, and people pretend like he didn't just say it. Like another example with the eugenics talking point is like, I think it was a TED talk. He said these sorts of things in multiple occasions, but like in the first sentence, he'll say, we have 8 billion people and it's too many. It's putting immense stress on the environment. And if we do a really good job with vaccines, we can lower that number to like 6 million or whatever by 2040. And it's like, isn't the purpose of a vaccine to save lives, Bill? Like, what the fuck are you talking about? And I don't know. It blows my mind now that I'm like doing the digging and looking at the world more clearly. It blows my mind that people don't realize like the problems with those sorts of like two-sided statements.
Yeah. And so let's jump on that, like the journey of the digging. Like, how clear has the picture become for you, and what have you found as you've been digging in terms of how all this is connected or maybe disconnected, but moving in a similar direction?
Yeah, I'm in an interesting position because anyone that doesn't know my story, I sort of blew up on the social media scene, starting digging into things like BlackRock and stuff on TikTok. And I think I just hit sort of like that financial pain point that we were talking about, where everyone was starting to ask a lot of questions and everyone was feeling the financial pain. And I jumped on the scene creating content that was like not just asking the questions, but all of my videos are based on showing evidence to support what I'm talking about behind, like in my videos. And not necessarily saying I know anything, but just showing that I'm trying to learn it and giving them the sources I'm learning from. And I think it spoke to a lot of people. And when I started, actually like just a little over a year ago now, a little more, I was not particularly informed. I've like got kind of a keen mind and I've got a good background in education. So I understand how to sort of like learn and teach myself, but, I'm not like some expert or anything. And so it's kind of like, I'm on the journey with everybody. And at first it was almost like the picture seemed clearer at first than it is now, because the more you learn, the more complexity kind of like becomes clear, the more you realize that everything is not as simple as you would love for it to be. But in another way, it does sort of start to paint a bigger picture. Like the picture does start to become clear, not as in like, we know exactly what's going on or we know who's doing everything, but just in terms of like, I think my perspective has shifted from sort of a simplistic, incorrect picture that I thought was right to a far more complicated and hard to understand picture that's sort of more based on like the forces that move in this world and the way force is exerted on culture and people and politics. And so in a way, there's way more detail I don't understand, but the patterns are a lot more clear and I'm a lot more certain is the wrong word. I feel a lot more confident in my understanding of that picture now.
Yeah. And how would you describe your understanding? Like what?
I would describe my understanding of the world as sort of like a series of judgments of probability of, like sort of like a multi-universe theory, as in we never really know what's going on. Even like when you like have like live your life in your little town with your family and stuff, it's like, you never really know what everyone's motivations are. You never really know what's true about history that you've learned in school. You don't necessarily know if the politicians are telling you the truth. And so I sort of look at the world as me assessing the probability of each different theory of what's going on, and including like what we're told is true. It's like, what's the chances that what we're being told is actually true? You look at the evidence, it's like, eh, maybe. And then I intentionally look at all the various conspiracy theories, because what that is inherently just someone trying to figure out what's going on and it's not yet proven. And often they get proven and proven true. And so I just try to learn about everything and sort of keep each sort of like line of reasoning or line of possibilities open. It's like different tabs in the browser, so to speak. And as you see evidence for each one, that one seems more likely, and they tend to tie together. And I don't know, I'm just kind of like a nerd for complexity. So I think that the way I see the world is like a whole bunch of open questions with varying degrees of probability to support them. And, you know, sometimes that hierarchy all rearranges.
Quick break here, freaks. This rip is brought to you by Gradually Then Suddenly, a framework for understanding Bitcoin as money by Parker Lewis. I wrote the foreword to the book. I'm honored to have done so because it's the best 0-to-1 primer if you're looking for a logical explanation of why Bitcoin obsoletes all other money. Buy one for yourself and maybe a few for your friends. Go to thesafehouse.com/gradually. That's thesafehouse.com, safe spelled S-A-I-F, thesafehouse.com/gradually. Use the promo code TFTC for $5 off at checkout. Buy it now, freaks. The price of Bitcoin is going up. You need to understand it. This is the best 0-to-1 primer. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Zaprite. If you're a Bitcoiner and run a business or an independent contractor, you should be accepting Bitcoin as payment. If not you, then who? If we believe that fiat is systemically fragile and is a risk, the rails that that currency runs on are a risk as well. You need to begin accepting Bitcoin as soon as possible. Invest in the future of your business. Create a redundant rail by accepting Bitcoin as payment using ZapRate and reduce risk for your business. I've done this for my business. Here at TFTC, we use ZapRate. It allows you to easily create invoices, payment links, or connect e-commerce stores, connect your wallets or custodial accounts, and be set up in minutes. We can also connect our bank accounts, our Stripe accounts, or Square accounts to accept fiat as well. The time is now, freaks. The fiat system is fragile. Invest in the infrastructure that de-risks the future. Invest in yourself. Bitcoin payments with ZapRate. Go to ZapRate.com/TFTC to get $40 off their annual subscription. ZapRate.com/TFTC. $40 off.
I think I've had a similar journey myself where I thought it was like this grand conspiracy that was very obvious, like in the Davos class, like all getting together, and you learn about some of these people. Some of them are objectively idiots, and then others are more apt at actually getting things done. And then you have countervailing forces. Like one of my favorite theories that we've talked about on the show over the last couple of years with Tom Luongo from the Gold Goats and Guns podcast is he's pretty well convinced that what we're seeing here in the U.S. in terms of Federal Reserve policy over the last 2 years is enacted by Jerome Powell and the commercial banks that own the Federal Reserve, sort of attacking the Davos class in their banking system, because if they get their way, a CBDC will come to market, which will cut out the commercial banks. So the commercial banks are owners of the Federal Reserve and are using Jerome Powell as this weapon against the European-centric view of a future built on central bank digital currencies. And
interesting.
And that would, a couple of years ago, I would have been wholly convinced that they were acting in concert with each other.
Yeah. But
it seems like there's a very strong theory.
That's a cool theory. And I think that it hits at the core, like one of the most fundamental, I think there's like fundamental building blocks of how we look at the world, that the more informed you get, you realize what are the most important parts of the world, because those are sort of like the things that move everything else. Like, yeah, the war in Ukraine is important. That's a big block. But currencies are far more important. And if you don't understand what is happening with the US dollar and with currencies and the people that control currencies, then you probably aren't getting the full picture of what's happening with that war, let alone the full picture of what's happening like with some small company over there. And I have had a similar take to you, is it's like, yeah, they're all the Western currency elite are probably working in concert, but you're right that it feels like we're in the stages of these powerful people know that currencies live and die in cycles and no currency lasts forever. And the US dollar is clearly, in the end stages of its life cycle. And so I think that, I don't know which, like what version of it we're in, but we're in some version of the people that understand those things, like the central bankers, the banking families that have been doing this for generations. They understand that the US dollar is going down and it's time to replace it at some point in the next, 20, 10, 100 years. And so I can only imagine, and from the evidence we see in the world around us, there are a number of different factions vying for the next currency cycle of the world. And you can trace that backwards in history, back through the pound and back further into history. And it only tracks that moving forwards. It's not like if some idiot like on the internet like me can figure out that, we're going to need new currency in the next 100 years, then I guarantee you the central bankers know that. And it's their job to try to, control the next currency, whatever it is. It makes a lot of sense that they would not necessarily all be aligned, even if they seem politically aligned.
Yeah. I mean, because it's a massive opportunity to control the reserve asset of the world, whether it's the dollar, a central bank digital currency. Now, with the seizing of Russian treasury assets a couple of years ago, you had the BRICS plus countries trying to band together to put together their own currency system. I think all of them, whether it's the dollar, I think the dollar is doomed. And I think the painting's on the wall. most people recognize this. And if you look at treasuries and understand how the treasury markets operate and how they should be operating, particularly with gold prices, like we've had a massive divergence in treasury yields and gold prices over the last year, year and a half. That's a product of all the countries that watched us take Russia's treasury asset. We probably can't hold treasuries. So China's been massively stacking gold while they're dumping their treasuries. And at the same time, you have like the Europeans trying to bring the CBDC to the fore. And I ultimately think all of them are going to fail. And that whether or not, I'm pretty confident that Bitcoin will supplant them, the timeline way less confident on. But when you think of the world of money, like that is what we have outside of our studio in Austin, which obviously I'm not in right now, but fix the money, fix the world. I think a lot of the core issues that exist in the world today stem from the fact that central banks and governments can print money in debt. Ex nihilo, and just do whatever they want with it.
I think that that is the core issue. I don't talk about it that way on my platform all the time because I think that that goes over a lot of people's heads. It's not as in it's too complex for them to understand. It just doesn't necessarily align with everyone's worldview. But I think that once you start to do the digging on how everything connects.
That was some weird synchronicity right there.
Bingo. You said that word. And once you get deeper into learning how everything works, I mean, especially once you learn about money, it's like money is just the tool by which we interact, right? Like you can't have a system of humans or any actors interacting in any sort of like exchange-based way. Like the moment you have property and people, money is the thing that binds us all together. And whoever can, it's not just like a lot of people think of it as just these things that we exchange, like just the money itself, but it's not. It's like the contractual agreement between people to work together, to cooperate. And without a system of contractual cooperation, there is no society. There is nothing. And so whoever controls the system by which we cooperate, that's like you have leverage over every facet of society of, you know, in everywhere. It's, and so the way I see it is, powerful people figured that out ages ago, like centuries, millennia ago, like ancient Babylon shit. But now today we're at a time where for the first time in history, it's not just that we have a, like, yeah, gold, you know, metals, physical currencies are pretty rad and they do a lot for sort of like democratizing commerce in like a way that the various versions of fiat currencies throughout history have not. But now that we have a technological currency that's based just on mathematics, that is inherently ungovernable and uncontrollable. And even if like, so there are like conspiracy theories that like there's ETHgate, and then there's conspiracy theories that Bitcoin was like a CIA operation and everything. And it's like, even if those are true, the technology itself is just the idea. It's just the inherent idea that mathematics makes the most sound type of money there is. And it's irreplaceable and it can always be spun up again, even though I don't think Bitcoin is I think that Bitcoin is exactly what we need. And so regardless of what these big power players try to do with our currency cycle moving forwards, the cat's already out of the bag. And the only way that they could stop the crypto, the decentralization of currency control would be at gunpoint all over the world simultaneously with an iron fist. And it's like, that's not going to happen. It's just not possible. So I don't think that we're going to a world where it's like Bitcoin is the currency and the only currency. I don't think that's going to happen by any means, but I certainly think we're going to a world where Bitcoin is like the currency. And there are lots of other currencies, I'm sure. There will be lots of cryptocurrencies. I bet there will be government fiat currencies still of various sorts, even though we're about to watch a lot of those crash and burn. I mean, hell, maybe we'll go to an all Bitcoin and digital currency-based situation. But regardless of what happens, Bitcoin is out of the bag, and there's no putting that back in the bag.
No, there isn't. And when you factor in the fact that Bitcoin exists, it's out of the bag. It's been around for 15 years. You layer on the digital age, particularly communication, social media, content distribution, like we're doing now. So we're going podcast, YouTube, Rumble. It's just going to get out there and it'll be easily accessible to other people. The fact that we can coordinate on the internet, and then you layer on like the debt situation globally. And if I were, it seems like to me, particularly post-COVID, that the prevailing forces that are either fighting each other or working with each other at different points in time have completely lost control. And I think it's mainly a factor of the digital age and the fact that we can all communicate. And when you begin to really internalize the amount of debt out there, and the fact that, like, I mean, the U.S. Treasury market and the U.S. dollar are overt Ponzi schemes that will never be paid back, or never be, the debt won't be made whole. And the currency has to hyperinflate to service the debt. And so both are pretty much screwed at the end of the day. And if I'm actually sitting in these positions of power and you're losing control, like, I think the path of least resistance to avoid social upheaval and something like a French Revolution, which I don't think anybody wants to see, many people will LARP about it, like, we need a French Revolution, but I don't think people really understand the history of how terrible it was.
Yeah, it's not the way.
But if I'm in a position of power and you see Bitcoin is here and you have these massive debt problems, like, and you want a quote unquote soft landing, like, the path of least resistance is to just let it flourish. And by let it flourish, I mean just let people use it and then fix the inherent problems that exist throughout the global economy that were created by fiat. There will be a lot of repricing in debt markets and in asset markets. People will be scooping up things for pennies on the dollar. But the fact that Bitcoin exists is actually a great escape route for this power structure that is, to me, obviously lost control.
That's a really good point. And I think that a lot of people try to address this question of, like, will there be Bitcoin adoption by the mainstream? Like, I think a lot of people always want everything to happen instantly. Obviously, they want easy answers that are instantaneous. And especially in finance, it's like regular people, myself included, before I had started to learn more, it's so easy to look at the financial world and assume that a thing would happen in a month. Like, that you know, people would see that this is happening and, like, they would shift, but it's inherently not the way. Like a lot of types of trades and contracts take years. But then a lot of, like, the power structures that are holding on to the legacy systems are, like, 70-year-old men that don't want to give up their power and aren't smart enough to realize what you just said. And then there's, like, a lot of 50-year-olds in there, 60-year-olds that are starting to get the picture of, like, yeah, the writing is on the wall. But I think that it will take a certain dying off of the stubborn elders of the system, combined with sort of like a rising up of the more progressively minded, or at least open-minded, youngers of the time, to sort of fully enact that shift. Because I think inherently there's a lot of, like, dinosaurs in politics and finance right now that just could never even begin to grasp that Bitcoin even is an option for them to get out of their predicament. Let alone accept that truth as sort of like a accepting defeat in some ways. But it's inevitable. And, like, I think that what you just described is actually, like, such a cogent take on it, that there isn't another way out. Like, you could try to invent a new fiat currency and lie to everyone as though it wasn't just another fiat currency, but the cat's kind of out of the bag now.
Yeah. And then it's, again, are you going to go to the arsonist to put out the fire? I mean, that's another thing I try to highlight, particularly for people who are extremely politically engaged and fall into the trap and the false framing, I would argue, of partisan politics, red team versus blue team. It's like, you are wasting your time and your energy. And to meet the new boss, same as the old boss, it's one big uniparty system, potentially controlled by intelligence agencies and a bureaucratic system that's been erected over decades that really doesn't change at all with a new president or a majority in Congress or the Senate. And like just focus on things that you can actually control. Like Bitcoin is a vote in a sense, in that you're voting like, hey, I don't want to operate in this fiat system. I'm going to go build on this open source protocol and the layers above it to solve these economic issues that exist.
Yeah, I think that in a similar vein, I think that monetary voting is the most effective form in all the forms of monetary voting. And a huge part of what I've done with my channel is actually digging into what corporations own all the products on our shelves, who owns sort of like all the various pieces of our daily lives, and then trying to find like small businesses, family and founder owned businesses, businesses that are not giant publicly traded mega corporations that are all managed by the same like five top shareholders, like all the management firms. Because when the more that we can get regular people voting with their dollars into companies that are managed by real regular people that care about their employees, that live in a community, that creates a circulation of currency within like regular people within our economy that is completely different than when you spend money at a giant corporation. It goes up into like the shareholders' coffers, and those, like, that system is inherently built to sort of keep insiders at the tables at the top and to have them managing the companies in a way that is sort of like a giant collusionary monopoly game where like all the competitors in an industry, like all the big pharma companies, their boards of directors are all elected by the same management firms, by the same top shareholders. And so like how much competition is there really in that system? And it's a system that inherently breeds corruption and incentivizes greed. And voting with your dollar to put our commerce outside of that system back into regular business owners, like regular people, I think it's just another example of like voting with your dollars by investing in cryptocurrencies and holding cryptocurrencies, same exact thing. It's like, take your money out of the banks. We've all seen what banks do these days. And we're about to see more of that, I think, this year. And I think that anytime, like, yeah, political voting is cool, but voting with your dollar is far more powerful.
Yeah. You just remind, have you ever read Strong Towns by Charles Morone?
I have not.
It's an incredible book that really highlighted like the economics of what you just described in the most lucent way that I've ever heard it described. And basically the concept, part of the book, he really compares like small towns, strong towns, like what you want to focus on from a small business perspective is revenue per square foot. And in a couple of chapters in the book, he highlights that superstores like Walmart and Target, their revenue per square foot is abysmal, but since they're these large conglomerates, they can eat that margin hit. But essentially when you go and you shop in these conglomerates within your small town, like they're taking that money and sending it back up to corporate. Yeah. And it's staying in your town, like you just described. And so you can make an economic argument that it actually, if you want to live in a better town, like you should focus on these small businesses because they, in terms of revenue per square foot, are much more efficient. And that money, like you said, stays within the local economy. Yeah. And that's one thing, again, you talked earlier about Bitcoiners really understanding the money problem, then seeking out and looking out in the world and trying to figure out where everything else is messed up. And food and healthy living is definitely, I think, one of the first that the Bitcoiners gravitated towards. And we've seen it with the beef initiative, which is an initiative to connect local ranchers with consumers in their local areas, and at the same time educate them about the ranchers about Bitcoin and why they should consider putting some Bitcoin on their balance sheets to make sure that they are financially viable into the long run. But down in Texas, where I'm typically at, it's been an incredible increase of quality to the food that we're eating just by that simple practice of going, shaking our rancher's hands and deciding consciously to buy locally instead of from Whole Foods. And that's not to say that we don't go to Whole Foods or grocery stores, but I think 60% of what we buy is local, which is a far bigger percentage than what it was 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah, it's cool how the sort of like the networks started built, like the internet allowed us to build networks of information and connections online. And that allowed us to learn a whole bunch of new things and share all that together. And that is now sort of like re-self-replicating into real life as what we have learned as a collective is changing the way that we all live in the real world as a community. And those types of connections are now reforming where like people are then being incentivized to, you know, form companies that tie people together, that like support local businesses, that like, that's so bullish in my opinion on humanity. Because like, I mean, to kind of like harken back to something we were talking about earlier, the food stuff, like the poison in our food and the healthcare conglomerate connections to the food and big agriculture poisons. That is one of the like, I struggle so hard not to just to believe that that is literally a like evil demonic conspiracy theory. Like the amount of sort of interplay between our sick care system and our food systems is just inherently evil shit. And it's so unbelievable that it would just sort of like happen by chance that way without like some form of literal collusion between the industries. And I think it is perfectly like plausible that it's just profit, greed, and corruption just in like cycling over the decades. But man, it's dark.
No, it really is. I mean, I think they're trying to, I mean, they're obviously some parts of this broader faction are trying to control food. Because again, whether it's ESG with the focus on energy systems and ushering in less reliable energy systems so that people are more dependent on the state, or food systems, like food, health is wealth. And what you eat literally affects how clearly you can think. And I am a believer that there's a concerted effort to completely poison people with the food. And you just look at, there's four major slaughterhouses here in the US. You look at the high fructose corn syrup that's in everything, the seed oils that are in everything, and what they're doing to people's bodies. And you can see it in the obesity stats and the heart disease stats. Like, there's an obvious corruption of the food system that is literally killing people.
I mean, it's like you can just point to each ingredient and like look at its side effects and look at how many people are eating that ingredient, and you can directly translate that into like X number of billions of dollars in the medications that cure that thing. And the problem, I mean, I'm kind of just putting that this in together in my mind right now, but like, if you have a healthcare system that is based on the model of a publicly traded company, like as in all of our big healthcare it's all publicly traded, like pharmaceutical companies, hospital conglomerate, like all of that being publicly traded is inherently building it on the model of the line has to go up every year, right? But the fundamental principle of healthcare sciences is that the line is supposed to be going down every year. We're supposed to be getting healthier every year as scientific technology expands our health and our not just our health care, but our health span. And so inherently, if we have a good medical system, there should be less and less profit in the healthcare industry every single year because there's not as much need for it. And so there's just this fundamental mismatching of the way that healthcare is incentivized versus the actual goal of a healthcare in the first place. And you're never going to wind up having a apparatus designed to make profit that profits off of curing sickness. That will never lead to having less sickness. Like, obviously.
No, it's a fiat standard because he's financial system driven by quarterly financials and that are attempting to produce cash flows and EBITDA that leads to stock value appreciation that outpaces inflation is all driven. Like, what is their benchmark? It's inflation. And they're printing money. Yep. And if you are deemed to be a successful company that helps people preserve or hopefully increase their purchasing power, you're basically racing against the debasement of the currency. And like, just what we have to do is flip it. It's like, all right, what if we lived in a world with sound money where your money gained in purchasing power and you weren't really racing inflation to produce these results, which is creating a perverse incentive system, which is incentivizing you to create lifelong patients instead of healthy people.
Yeah.
Like, how could that change? And it's all, and even like the food, like that goes back to the money too. Like it's not a coincidence that we were ripped off the gold standard officially in 1971. And then the food pyramid came out not too long after. And the idea there is that, again, going back to what I said earlier, people really begin to react when the lower layers of Maslow's hierarchy of needs get attacked. And so food prices going up needs to be averted at all costs. And so you launched a food pyramid and you just create these cheap substitutes that you tell people are healthy. And so they go and they start eating that and their grocery bill is cheaper because the good stuff that is harder to produce because you have a shitty currency that's more expensive. If you tell them the cheap substitutes are better, like it's, they're going to feel like they're saving money at the grocery store. But over the course of 50 years, it's made people woefully unhealthy. And it's a terrible decision too, because on the back end, you described this earlier, like the healthcare cost of treating all these unhealthy people. You sort of created another massive problem that's going to be
way more expensive, right?
Yeah.
Like healthcare is by far the biggest expense. A lot of people try to act like the American federal budget is mostly military spending, but it's not. Healthcare is by far the biggest expenditure on the American budget. And so that's like all of us paying this medical industry, the big pharma, to like basically like a lot of what they do is actually sort of like we pay for the, I mean, Fauci is a good example. Fauci's playbook throughout his whole career is to use taxpayer government money to do all of the expensive research and development of new drugs that may or may not work, because that's the part that a company wouldn't want to pay for, is the part that's like, I don't know, it's like experiments. Who knows if it's going to work? They get all that done on taxpayer dime. Then they hand the patents off to a pharmaceutical company once the drug is ready to get made. They get a kickback now because they've now got patent rights over these products that they created with our taxpayer dollars. And then the pharmaceutical company just goes ham on the drug, produces it having skipped all that overhead. And then they just make a shitload of money giving us the drug that we funded ourselves, and they inflate the prices on it. I think that a lot of people kind of ask like, how did we get here? Like, how the fuck did we get to this much corruption? I see it as sort of two sides to that answer, is in like, yeah, there's the frog in the water getting slowly cooked. Like the fire slowly heats up the water and you boil. So you never really realize you're getting cooked from our perspective. But I think a lot of people don't necessarily flip the script and think of it from the other, like these evil motherfuckers' perspective of like, it's not like they had a full playbook from the start and they've been orchestrating the same exact plan since like day one, but rather that they're learning as they go too. Like they're playing this game, and as new technologies come out, they realize how they can use that. They make mistakes, they adjust. And I mean, the food pyramid and the way that food has evolved is a good example, where it's like after World War II, there's all this industry producing these things that are not like, not, there's no market for them anymore. And a lot of those things that were made for the war industry then got repurposed into the fucking food industry. And then that gives rise to a bunch of like, let's say, questionable health outcomes. And then the medical industry is like, oh, that's pretty profitable. How can we incentivize more of that? And so over time, the system has evolved out of sort of like us getting slowly cooked and them realizing, learning how to slow cook, so to speak.
Yeah. No, show me the incentives and I'll show you the outcome. I mean, you can apply this to anything. You get like education, right? Like Obama came out and said, hey, millennials, you've been told your whole life, you got to go to college, get your degree. And so we're going to subsidize that. You can come get federal loans. We're not going to ask any questions. And then the university sees that as like, oh, the government's just going to give these kids all the money that they need to come to our university. So we're going to jack up our prices. And that's why we've seen that. Tuition costs go up by obscene amounts over the last two decades. And
quality go down too, because like, who cares?
Oh, you increase your inflation, you create this whole middle management layer within universities, and the administrators take over and completely corrupt the curriculum. And again, like perverse incentives, like since you're going to get all this money, now you're incentivized to essentially show high school students like, we're a really good university, so you have grade inflation. It's like, oh, the average student here gets like a 3.5 to a 4.0. like we only have the smartest people, and really in reality they're just dumbing down everybody, making it easier, or not even making it easier, just throwing in bell curves that inflate everybody's grade.
You actually, you made me kind of think of when you said, when you talked about incentives here, I've been kind of keying into this thing about Bitcoiners as people for a little while now. And you totally fit this pattern too, is like Bitcoiners tend to have this like really like chill vibe, like a vibe of like not being in a hurry to get anywhere, so to speak. And obviously I'm generalizing, but like a lot of times I'll meet Bitcoiners and there's just this air of like not the rat race about it. And I hadn't quite put two and two together before to realize that like everyone that operates from a fiat based worldview is inherently incentivized by inflation. Even if they don't understand inflation, they're just incentivized by the inflationary nature of fiat based life to always be needing to like get the next thing done. Always, I got to go to work. I got to make my money. I got to pay my bills, because you're like every piece of our understanding of society has been built on this mindset that comes out of like, if you don't go fast enough and hard enough, it's all going to get away from you because the inflation is inherent to the system. But the moment you flip to a sound money where it's actually the opposite, it's almost like the more you chill out and trust the system and invest, the better it is. It's like the more abundance you have, you just inherently wind up with this like different, what I'm saying is that I'm starting to observe it in people that truly understand Bitcoin. Almost everyone that I meet is just inherently like not stressed and not in a rush, because the longer I wait, the better everything gets.
Low time preference, the power of low time preference. And it's funny. Yeah. Like it took me a while, when that concept of low time preference is like sitting, waiting and staying humble and stacking sats is one of the phrases that the Bitcoiners use. Yeah. Once you see it, once you've been around for a cycle or two, like you can see it like literally in your net worth and the Bitcoin that you saved. If you've had the luxury of, or had the ability, I won't say luxury, and everybody's had access to Bitcoin for well over a decade now, but if you've had the ability to save in Bitcoin, you've seen the products of sitting and waiting, paying out and massively towards your benefit. And yeah, I think that's a key thing that people really need to recognize who are stuck on the hamster wheel, is like your time preference is artificially geared towards high time preference. Like you have to go out there and rush and try to make as much money as possible because you're saving in a currency that's being debased at an increasing rate.
I mean, there's a whole other incentive scheme too, to saving something like Bitcoin, where you realize that it's not just that you're stacking sats. It's that you're also learning to be conservative with your sats, because you know that in the future they will be worth more than they are today. And so there's almost this like reverse incentive scheme of like, yeah, I can use them as a currency right now too, but like maybe I don't need, like, do I really need that thing? Like, do I really need all this bullshit that's in my life? Or would I rather keep this stack as tall as it is? Because we're not necessarily incentivized in that same way with dollars at all. Like, your dollars aren't going up. Like, yeah, people are incentivized to save just from the intellectual reasons why you should save. But the moment that you're saving in a currency like Bitcoin, there's this whole other like mental awareness of conservation and like less is more. Or, like, you know what I mean? It's like, suddenly you're very motivated to save and to just chill out and not consume so much.
Not only that, it drives a large sense of optimism in my life, because you just play it forward. Like, all right, if this low time preference sit and wait has worked for me individually, if you play that out and you think about a town adopting Bitcoin, a nation adopting Bitcoin, the world adopting Bitcoin, like it has the like profound effects on how society coordinates and actually makes decisions and fixes. Again, I think everything is incentive driven, whether it's the corruption that exists at the highest levels of the power structure or individually, like trying to pay your bills and build a family, whatever it may be. Incentives run every decision made at every level. And Bitcoin, I just think, fixes the incentive system and forces people to think, like you just mentioned. Like, you think about all the money that's been printed and thrown at a bunch of bullshit and education, healthcare, food, war, whatever it may be. Like, if you can't print money at will to fund all those things, they're not going to be funded. Like if you have a hard currency that's extremely scarce, people have to begin to weigh the consequences of opportunity costs. Like if I spend my Bitcoin on this and it actually doesn't produce value for people at the end of the day, there's a good chance I don't get that Bitcoin back. And so you're forced to really allocate towards things that are actually going to increase productivity and quality of life at the end of the day.
You kind of just put something together in my mind too, the more you're talking about incentives and how like that sort of inherent optimism when you look forwards at what will inevitably result of the sort of decentralized incentive scheme of Bitcoin, the sound incentive scheme of Bitcoin. And when I juxtapose, when I transpose that to the decentralized media that we are talking about a lot here, and like the way that our information space is opening up, that is a similar like inherent restructuring of incentive schemes. Because a lot of people are always asking me like, how are we gonna like overcome like the banking cabal? How are we gonna like stop the war? Like all these like kind of political and information questions. And it's like, yeah, maybe there's some easy, quick answers, but the real answers is like, you have to change it long-term by changing our like cultural incentive schemes, by changing the way that we all choose to interact and choose to engage. And like in a similar way, when you decentralize the media, everyone's incentives are different. Like Don Lemon tries to come to on X and do the same old mainstream media bullshit, and suddenly no one's paying attention because it's like, we don't care what you have to say because we have a whole new, like the world is decentralized here. And obviously there's growing pains and there's a lot of complexity involved in the transition from centralized to decentralized systems. But when I look at it in the money system and what you're describing about Bitcoin there, when I look at it in the media space and what it's doing there, it's like, I feel like it's this sort of like concurrent revolution across all of our spaces where technology is allowing us to decentralize all the main systems we use. And I think it's inherently bullish in every direction.
Yeah. Well, you ready to go further down this rabbit hole?
Yeah, let's go, dude.
What are your, what's your knowledge about the intersection of these two spaces? Like, are you aware of podcasting 2.0 or new communication
a protocols? Little, like Noster type of things?
Yeah.
Minorly. I would love to learn more.
Well, I mean, so I'm sure you've heard like the Web 3.0 meme in crypto, like Ethereum, like, oh, you can tokenize your soul or whatever and monetize and like create your own token. I think the idea of Web 3.0 makes a lot of sense, but the implementation that many crypto projects have brought to the market is completely wrong. I think really what we need to do is combine open content distribution protocols with Bitcoin, essentially. And we're beginning to see that manifest in multiple ways. And I think the two most popular would be podcasting 2.0, which Adam Curry, the podfather, the inventor of podcasting, he's a Bitcoiner, and he's been working with a movement of open source developers to integrate Bitcoin into RSS. And so when I send this podcast out, when I publish this, it'll go out via RSS, and in my RSS feed, I have a Bitcoin address. And now there are podcasting apps that are popping up with Bitcoin wallets, and people who are listening can send me Bitcoin if they like a particular episode. And so there you have this meritocratic signal in terms of filtering out good content versus bad. If people are parting ways with their Bitcoin to signal that they liked a particular episode, the cream sort of rises to the top, because you know the incentives aren't likes or retweets. It's like, I'm giving you Bitcoin because I got value out of the content you put out there. And so you have this literal monetary signal going out to the rest of the market. And then similarly on Noster, which is an open source communications protocol that's decentralized as well, they've done the same thing where you can put a Bitcoin address in your profile. And as you post on Noster, people can signal with Bitcoin about the quality of the content that you're putting out there. And so you have open content distribution in RSS and Noster combining with open source money to create like a new way to have the cream rise to the top in terms of like content that people are getting value out of.
Dude. Yeah. I mean, it makes so much sense. And I've been, while you're describing it, I've been trying to, in my brain, sort of like figure out what's the difference between that when you're using Bitcoin versus that when you're using dollars. And I think what I'm arriving at is that the Bitcoin world is like a sandbox where there's only this much sand in it. And the grains of sand we've got are all the sand we're going to get. And so what we're doing there is we're sort of like pushing little piles of sand around to vote on the cultural landscape that we think is valuable, right? To vote on the ideas we think is valuable, the companies we think are valuable, but it's never going to leave the sandbox. And there's never going to be a whole bunch of new sand dumped into the sandbox. And that creates a really different, like, just background incentive scheme for why and how you, you know, promote someone, give them some sats, and like kind of push that sand around to show out, to like vote for what our world should and does look like. Whereas when it's dollars, you're like sort of inherently giving away a thing that we all sort of think of as like, it's going to disappear, because it will, it'll inflate away to nothing, but also like it'll leave your hands and go to a place where it's never coming back from, like some bank account of some billionaire that is kind of causing the inflation in the first place. Like dollars inherently all flow upwards into dark corners that they will never leave. And like some circulate for a while, like some go back and forth between regular people for a while, but inevitably like the thing causing inflation is all these like dark bank accounts at the top that are just collecting all of our inflated shit. And so in a way it's like, it's never coming back. It's like having like, it's like sandbox leaking out the bottom all the time and everyone's always bringing in new buckets. And that's inherently not as fun of like a creative space to sort of like build piles in and sort of like push things around, because it's all just falling out the bottom all the time.
No, and that's only one aspect of it. The other aspect too is like, if you're out there producing content that people don't like, they just simply cut off your access to those fiat rails. So we've seen this throughout the, I mean, I've had it happen to me on YouTube during COVID. We got demonetized like two or three times, and we've seen it with WikiLeaks. We've seen it with Alex Jones and many other content creators out there. And that's the beauty of this implementation as well, is that it's an open source peer-to-peer protocol. So I put my address, I put my address in my RSS feed and I control it. There's nobody can say you can't send money to this address because we don't like what he's saying. Like, nope. There's nobody between me and the listeners sending us Bitcoin, which is a whole nother like incentive driver in terms of getting good information out there, because you can't be censored by the payment rails.
And if you choose to create, if you choose to build the platform in a way that the more payments receives is like the boost that the algorithm gets, like the popularity is tied to how much people are valuing it, there's no censorship that can be applied to that, because it's an open source blockchain vote for the content. And so it's not like you can deboost it. You can't shadow ban it. It's just the number is what it is, and it's on the blockchain. And so you make good shit, and good shit spreads. That's really interesting.
Yeah. That's the, I think we're at the precipice of people beginning to wake up to this. And I think it's going to be accelerated, particularly in election year. That's what's, I think, that's what's going to happen. That's why I've built everything that we've built here at TFTC from like inside out, like as robust as possible with Bitcoin at the core. We do fund a lot of what we do here via advertisements. We try to partner with companies in the Bitcoin space that we trust and we use and that we think other people should be using. But when we send our invoices out, you can pay in fiat, but we also have the ability to pay in Bitcoin, then putting a Bitcoin address in the RSS feed and then putting stuff on Nostr that can be monetized there. Like, we want to make sure that we have this uncensorable, decentralized rail to receive money in case we say something at some point down the line where Stripe or our corporate bank account gets taken down.
I'm kind of ashamed I haven't done this yet, actually. This is definitely going on my list for this week.
It's still very early, but I think every content creator, particularly those of us who are, I think you especially, are pushing the edge of what is wrong think, should have a fallback option.
Yeah, we're putting that's notes going on the screen here.
Yeah,
my buddy Ben Wehrman has been poking me to get on Nostr for a while, and that's going to happen. Have you interviewed Nicole Shanahan by chance, RFK Jr.'s VP?
I have not, no.
You really should, dude. She's a Bitcoiner, and her partner is Jacob, I forget his last name, who is in charge of Lightning Labs for a long time. And mm-hmm. they are, so like RFK Jr.'s whole campaign is very pro-crypto, and they've got a lot of like awareness and progressive takes on it. But like I interviewed Nicole Shanahan a week ago or so and got into it a little bit with her. And it was immediately apparent that her knowledge vastly outpaced mine, and that she has a ton of really interesting takes on Bitcoin and has been in it for years and years and years and years and years from like a legal standpoint and all that. It was like, it was a really interesting conversation, and I did not even have the technicals to follow her halfway down the places that she could have gone. I think you'd really enjoy talking to her. I mean, probably Bobby too, but
yeah, I've done a Twitter Spaces with Bobby before with a bunch of other Bitcoiners, probably about a year ago now at this point. But yeah, not yeah. talking to Nicole, and no, I think that's why I'm beating this drum for 7 years now. It's actually the newsletter I started that predated this podcast, will turn 7 this week.
Nice. And good work.
It is it's so obvious to me, again going back to the incentives, yep. the monetary incentives, the injecting that monetary tool into content to monetize directly, like it changes the incentives of content creation. I've worked a lot in the mining space, and so I've learned more about energy systems in the last 6 years than I ever thought I would in my life. And when you really understand the connection of the digital world, the Bitcoin blockchain, and sending transactions digitally, and the physical world of the energy it takes to actually add blocks of transactions to the network, and the symbiotic relationship that Bitcoin mining brings to energy systems, it's extremely positive, and it's well extremely misunderstood by the mainstream.
Yeah,
I think
yeah, it is.
We're boiling
well, it's intentionally obfuscated and
yes.
mispainted, right? Yeah. I mean, I think that the centralized powers realized way too little, way too late, how big of an issue Bitcoin was for them, and I think Satoshi and the various players in the early days of Bitcoin, I think that they very wisely built fast enough and quietly enough for long enough that like by the time that the centralized powers realized what they had on their hands, they already weren't able to stop it. Like
it's yeah, already Satoshi's don't kick the hornet's nest comment is very prescient, and you can tell
yeah.
he or the group of people that made up Satoshi, whatever it was, thought really hard and critically about these problems. And that's the other beauty of it too, incentives. Like I think that's one of the great things that Bitcoin does, is it holds up a mirror to the power structure and really puts them in this predicament, because they're like, we want to be environmentally friendly. We want like equal access, equal opportunity for people. We want to fix the wealth gap and help people in the lower stratum of the economic ladder to build themselves up. And Bitcoin literally enables all of this. So if you're pushing ESG and you really care about stewarding the environment, it's like, well, Bitcoin mining makes sure that we're as efficient as possible with our energy systems, whether that's mitigating flare gas in oil and gas fields or making sure that grid systems are robust and have enough revenue to reinvest in themselves. Like you can't deny that Bitcoin's a net positive there. And then if you really care about social inequality and wealth inequality, well, like Bitcoin gives any individual who so chooses to preserve their purchasing power in a hard money, and historically that has worked out very well for the people that did. So yeah. You're trying to say it's bad and you want to solve these problems, like, and that's why again I'm incredibly optimistic, and people get caught up in the 24-hour news cycle and get very black-pilled, but it's like if you take a step back, it's happening. Bitcoin's $1.5 trillion market cap now. Nobody thought it would be this large 5 years ago, let alone 10, 15 years ago.
Oh, it's going to get a lot bigger too.
It's yeah.
It's going to get a lot bigger.
And I don't think people recognize how quickly it's happened. Like it's like 15 years yeah. is not a long time.
No. And I think that a lot of people think they don't realize how early on in the progress we still are. It's like, I think a lot of people have this bias towards thinking that like what the mountain we see below us is inherently probably the whole mountain, when it's like, no, like it's very likely when you look at the bigger picture that actually we are still very much in the first chapter, very much still early adoption. Like there is a lot of mountain ahead of us. It's wild.
Yeah. I mean,
Yeah. Think about how many companies and business, like, and people and governments have not adopted it yet.
Like, no, and that's the thing too. I think we're particularly at a point in time where the career risk for people, particularly working in corporations and institutions, it's flipping, where for the first 15 years, people have been able to look at Bitcoin and say, it's too risky. I don't want to get involved. I'm not going to put my clients' money at risk here. And I think we're at the point now where if we have another one of these cycles and people have not adopted Bitcoin into their corporate treasury strategy or enabled individual investors whose money they're stewarding to get access to Bitcoin, people are going to be like, you're fired. Like, you literally missed out on the best returning asset in human history.
Overlaid, well, there's probably more bank failures on the way. Like, there's more fiat financial turmoil on the way.
Did you see the most recent FDIC report?
Yeah. But 137, I forget my numbers here of how many trillions of unrealized.
512, I believe. 17, yeah.
Yeah, 517 trillion of unrealized losses. Which, to be fair, like, it got reported billion, as though it was like,
so like half a trillion, right?
Yes, 517 billion. Thank you. Yeah. And it got reported as though it was like it came out of nowhere and it just dropped. It's like, to be fair, the amount of unrealized losses in the banking system has been about that high for quite some time now. But that stress is weighing heavily.
Yeah. And as Jerome Powell keeps these rates higher for longer, it's only going to, the stress is only going to get much more intense from here. And you're beginning to see cracks. You're beginning to see realized losses. I'm not sure if you saw, but Deutsche Bank sold an office building they bought in Manhattan this week. I think they bought it in 2014 for $550 million and sold it for, I think, at 60% below that. I think it was like 130. Or that would be more than 60%. It took like a 60 to 80% loss on that. And that's a realized loss.
Yeah. And, you know, the vast majority are still unrealized. And some of them are probably even unreported because there's so much self-reporting in the system. There's so much manipulation of balance sheets to make, you know, the various leverage positions everyone's holding kind of hold their water. I mean, I'm a little biased because I come from the GameStop community. And so I've done a lot of digging into sort of like how much risky betting is happening in the markets in various ways, how much sort of like swaps are being used to kind of hide positions so that collateral looks bigger than it is and leverage looks more managed than it is. But I mean, it just takes like one flick to knock the wrong dude over, like how Archegos blew up and then Credit Suisse blew up. And then it's like quickly like, put a plug in it. I mean, they were asking for, I forget how much money, but they were needing a bailout from the government like 2 or 3 months ago. So,
yeah. And I'm not sure if you caught this, but the Fed in a sly roundabout way and the Treasury really papered over that unrealized losses problem by taking Treasuries out of the reserve ratio a couple months ago. And so like the BTFP program was ending in March and people thought they were going to extend it, but instead of extended it, they're like, hey, we're staying true to our word, we're ending the BTFP program. And then slyly behind the scenes, they're like, all right, you don't need treasuries to count your reserve ratio anymore, you can buy as many as you want and we won't care.
It's a recurring strategy where they just, you know, create a new loophole, find a new way, like, you know, change the reporting, change the way you report inflation. And it's cool now to like have gone from a place where I was basically just ignorant maxi to being like involved in communities and all the different niches of like thought, where I'm like no expert at anything, but like in my financial network of homies that are doing this digging in the financial space, like there's so much digging into the publicly available information to expose those loopholes and to get that information out to people like me, to help get that information out to other people around. It's like, it's so cool that they can't hide that shit anymore.
Yeah. And that's, and to that point too, that's something that the strategy of this show specifically over the last 3 years, I would say, is really like in the first 4 years of the podcast, we were like Bitcoin focused, Bitcoin developers, Bitcoin CEOs of companies in the Bitcoin space talking about Bitcoin specific news. But I think 3 years ago, particularly during COVID, it was like, all right, like I think everybody in Bitcoin has heard all of this. Like, we need to go get people like Ian Kendall, who are in these tangential sort of niches, these verticals, and we need to begin cross-pollinating these ideas, because I think disparately we're all putting this together. And I think if we were to combine, not necessarily combine forces, but information share, like, hey, this is how we think Bitcoin, like GameStop was like a big thing. As GameStop was going down, everybody in Bitcoin was like, we get what you're doing philosophically. Yeah. We agree with you philosophically, but the answer is not to try to destroy the system within the system by squeezing the shorts. It's like, they're going to fucking manipulate the system no matter what happens. Like, you have to work outside. And that's what I think a lot of Bitcoiners, when GameStop were going down, were like, guys, this is great, but that's not the solution. It's over here. Yeah. And I think as time goes on,
it created a lot of Bitcoiners too. As they saw how broken the system was, a lot of GameStop people started to learn about crypto. They're like,
you turn the buy button off. It's like, you have the Black Friday. Like, and that actually, a lot of gamblers are in Bitcoin because of Black Friday in the poker world. Like, same thing happened. They just turned off the withdrawal money button. They're like, what the hell just happened?
I mean, I agree with what you're saying about how, like, I think a lot of people are starting to realize that we have a lot more in common, like, among our different niches and across our different verticals than we might have at first thought. And the more that these spaces are, maybe I just see it more because I'm kind of a cross-pollinator in the nature of my content, but it's so cool to start to like share audiences and sort of like cross ideas over where like a lot of us are on. I mean, I think maybe a lot of it is sort of like, not necessarily libertarian is kind of a charged word, but like liberty, like popular people focused initiatives and solutions to problems that we all share. That is like universal across so many different spaces right now. And so it's cool to sort of like get everyone talking together and learning from each other, because you can't be an expert at everything. You can't know everything, but there is someone somewhere that is an expert on everything and knows just about everything.
Yeah. And this is what gives me hope. And it feels like we're at, like, again, going back to COVID, maybe the most massive inflection point of 100%. I lived through 9/11, great financial crisis, but I don't know what it was about COVID. Maybe it was a culmination of the last 20 years with going all the way back to 9/11, rolling that into the great financial crisis, rolling that into COVID. I think for me, a millennial in my early 30s, like, I was very aware of each event as it was happening, and you had the compounding effect of all those. And then finally COVID being the cherry on top. It's like, all right, this is completely insane. Like, we need to begin seeking alternatives. And over the last 3 years post COVID, you had people running in their own siloed verticals, GameStop, people focused on bodily autonomy and fighting the vaccine, and Bitcoiners as well. And now everybody's sort of coming out of the hole of their own vertical, like looking up and seeing like over, like, oh, these guys are onto something too. Right. And maybe we're at like in a transitionary period. It's like, all right, we've all gone and done our homework about these verticals that we know very well. We know a lot about. Now let's get up and try to work together to solve these problems outside of the system, which I think is possible. And I think that's another thing I say a lot on this show, is like, we're going to win. And it's like to instill confidence in people. So many people have been dejected. Like, this is a daunting, these are daunting problems to try to solve. The power structure is too powerful, but it's not the case at all. We can actually do this if you put some effort behind it and work smartly.
Yeah. I mean, they are daunting, but like, we got this. And, you know, when you put all of our, like, when you put hundreds of thousands, even millions of brilliant people together into like a connected network of free thinking, forwards moving, like, that's like, we can solve some daunting problems, and we already are and have. And I think that what you're saying about COVID being like the inflection point is spot on, because every one of those other issues or like events was massive and did change everything, but it didn't, like, COVID affected regular people in a tyrannical way en masse around the entire world. And so everyone of every sort came out of that with a shared experience of like regardless of how much you bought it or not, it's like there was still a shared experience of sort of like, awareness of the corruption above us and awareness of like the separation of the classes and it not being, well, some people are still trapped in the left and right, but like a lot of people woke up to that it's actually top and bottom. And that's where I think all these verticals are starting to blend, where it's like, yeah, we're all down here together and I think we need our own solutions. And then we're looking around, it's like, oh shit, you've already got a solution to that big part. And like, oh fuck, this guy's got a solution to that part. And it's a really fun time right now. It's a little stressful, but it's super fun.
It's stressful. And again, like we said earlier, like you have to be aware of these problems and they are daunting, but you have to like that. I think the world needs more optimism too. Cause I think that's a self perpetuating feedback loop too. It's like, again, instilling confidence in people. Once people are confident, they recognize there's alternatives. They begin using those alternatives and building on them. And that gives them more confidence. And it's like, oh, well, we may actually be able to do this. And I think that is what the power structure fears the most. And funnily enough, what they use the most is fear, try to scare the shit out of people so they don't even look into stuff. Bitcoin's only for drug dealers and terrorists. Like, stay away from that. It's destroying the planet. And they're trying to scare people away from it because they're scared that its power is such that it could replace them.
Yep. Yeah, it's there's nothing more powerful than a informed and like energetic, motivated population. Like,
yeah, be optimistic, people. We got this. We do.
Yeah. And for me, I mean, people ask me that all the time. Like, how do you stay so optimistic when you're always reporting on this corruption and bullshit? And it's kind of just like the default. It's like, how could you not? Like, there's no way forwards. The more you learn about how much is wrong with the world, like, there is no other way forwards than to laugh and to take it on. It's like, bring it on, guys. Like, whatever. Like, you know, history is history. Time, like, the world is the world. We'll take it. Like, we got it. Yeah. If you don't look at it with optimism, you're not like, you have no chance whatsoever.
No, and that's what pisses them off the most is when I gave a presentation on TFTC and like the media company we're trying to build and the topics that we talk about in the Q&A. Somebody asked me like, are you afraid of the power structure? It's like, no, that's what they want. Like, and you have to recognize that's what they want. And if you allow them to make you fearful, like, they win. And it is big F you just being like, I'm not afraid. Like, we're going to talk about this and we're going to do these things and not care about the hammer coming down on us. It may come down, but can't show fear.
Yeah, bring it on. We've, you know, the hammer's come down before and we're starting to build systems and networks and, you know, payment strategies and such that start to make it a little less and less relevant until eventually the hammer is not going to be relevant at all.
Yeah. It's a beautiful time to be alive. Ian,
yeah,
I don't want to take up too much of your afternoon here. I know we threw this together somewhat last minute, but this was an incredible conversation. Thank you for the work that you do. Thank you for coming on.
Yeah, thanks, dude. It's cool to be, not every podcast that you go on is sort of like a process of putting new pieces together and like arriving at new conclusions mid podcast. And this is a ton of fun. I've got a lot of cool digs to do now.
Yeah, we'll have to do this again. And yeah, if you have any questions about Bitcoin, Nost, or whatever it may be, feel free to hit me up. And as you can tell, very passionate and committed to this. So,
hell yeah, brother. Appreciate it, man.
All right.
And I will talk to you again soon.
All right. Peace and love, freaks.